welcome to a special two-part edition of Meet the Writers. My guest today is the critically acclaimed author of 12 books. He became an instant literary celebrity in 1984 when he was just 29 with Bright Lights, Big City, a contemporary classic which has been described as one of the generation-defining novels of the 20th century. He published Brightness Falls in 1992, which ends with Black Monday, The Good Life in 2006, which starts with 9/11, and his most recent book, Bright Precious Days, is the third in the series, which revolves around Manhattan couple Russell and Corinne Calloway. The new book, like its predecessors, is set against a major historical event, in this case, the financial crisis of 2008. The Calloways are still together. Russell now heads a small independent publishing house with a focus on literary fiction. The author has won awards and critical acclaim, has been published all over the world and sold millions. His works appeared in some of the most prestigious publications, and alongside his literary contributions, he's an expert on wine, writing a monthly column on the subject, currently for Town and Country magazine. He's written screenplays and appeared in the hit TV series Gossip Girl. He was named as a literary lion by the New York Public Library. Jay McInerney, welcome to Meet the Writers. Now, you're a quintessential New York voice, but actually you were born in Connecticut, where your father worked for a paper company, and you moved around a lot in your early years, settling here.
I did, including Oakshott.
That's right.
Not too far from here.
Tell me about that and your parents. Why did you move so often?
My father was an executive. He eventually was the director of marketing for a Scott paper company, and his job entailed sort of moving to different markets to take charge. And when he came here, he was working for Bowater Scott, which I guess was affiliated with Scott Paper Company. And so we were here for 2 years when I was, I guess, seven and eight, perhaps. But one of many, many stops along the way, I think I went to about 14 schools before high school. So I really didn't have a hometown to write about, which is one of the reasons I think that I adopted New York. Because when I arrived there at the age of 21, I just sort of thought, hey, this is the place I've been looking for all along. And it was.
Can England claim that this was where you found your literary voice? Did you write your first poem here,
I read? Oh, gosh, yes, I did. I can even recite it for you. Old King John was a dreamy lad. He went swimming in the sea. He got bitten by a crab. I was very obsessed with the English kings, you know. I read about them and memorized the order and the succession. And so that must be where the King John part comes in. My father uncovered this, you know, some years ago and showed it to me. And I don't know what I was then. He went, you know, I don't know why I sent King John to the beach. But anyway, that's my first known poem or known writing of any kind.
You lived in Canada, too.
I lived in Vancouver, Canada, for several years, actually. It was one of my longer stays. It's a very beautiful place.
What were you reading?
Well, when I was living in Vancouver, one of the things I remember reading was Jack London, you know, White Fang and Call of the Wild. And surprisingly, I was a real outdoorsman then. I imagined myself as maybe a fur trapper or a mountain man or an explorer. And it's really quite hard to believe given how things turned out. But I went through several potential career paths before I read Dylan Thomas at the age of 12 or so. And that kind of changed everything for me. And then I wanted to be a writer.
A poet, too?
A poet, yeah. Yeah, just Dylan Thomas kind of, it was like a light going on for me. And we read Fern Hill in my eighth grade English class. And I was absolutely mesmerized. And I subsequently got Thomas's collected poems. And I conceived this very unlikely ambition, which was to be a poet. And for quite a number of years, that was my dream, was to be a poet, to write poetry. And I wrote quite a bit of bad poetry. until I discovered, I don't know, it was a combination of Hemingway and James Joyce that converted me to fiction mm-hmm. when I was in college.
Well, in fact, in your latest book, Russell reads Ulysses and says that really there's no point for anyone else.
Yeah, I actually had a classmate who, when I read Ulysses, probably at the age of around 18 or 19, my reaction was, wow, this is amazing what you can do with prose. And I had a very smart and ambitious classmate whose reaction was at that point, you know, it's hopeless. And he went from being an aspiring writer to thinking it's all been done, and he stopped writing at that moment. Fortunately, I found it inspiring. And I mean, that was really one of the seminal influences, that and Hemingway. And just about that time, also, Raymond Carver began to publish, and I discovered his work very early on, and that was also a big influence. And he eventually became a teacher and a mentor to mm-hmm. me.
Mm-hmm. And I'd like to explore that relationship a little bit further on. But first, I'd like to talk about Gary Fiskett, John, because you met him at college.
Right, at Williams College in probably 1975. And I was about to say we immediately hit it off, but actually we didn't immediately hit it off. First, we hated each other, and then we became friends. Everybody was always telling me about this. You know, he actually transferred in from another university, and people were telling me about this new student I would love because he also was a writer, and he was, you know, the new kid in the English department, as it were. And so, of course, my initial reaction was to not like him. And there was some romantic rivalry that was involved as well.
But, who got the girl?
But eventually, I got the girl, actually. Eventually, though, we became great friends. And we actually, when we graduated, we kind of emulated Kerouac and took off across country together. Had a little sort of 3-month road trip looking for America. And eventually we had to look for jobs too, and that was a miserable failure when we went to San Francisco and we couldn't find any newspaper jobs because Woodward and Bernstein had made journalism the most popular profession of 1976, I guess, was the year we graduated, 1977. And so then we both had to retreat home and think of our next strategy.
But Fiskett, John, in fact, became your editor and is still your editor.
Yes. In fact, after that adventure, he went to the Harvard Radcliffe publishing program, something I think still exists. And he then went to New York and got a job with Random House and worked his way up pretty quickly. I went off to Japan and had a few other adventures. And I returned to New York in the very end of 1979, and he helped me to get a job as a reader at Random House. I used to read the unsolicited manuscripts. And while I was there, he also introduced me to Raymond Carver, who had stopped by to visit his own editor. And I ended up spending most of the day with Ray Carver chatting and getting him up to Columbia University for his reading that evening, and we stayed in touch. And when I was fired from my job as a fact checker at the New Yorker, Carver suggested that I come and study fiction with him at Syracuse University.
And you did, and he was very influential.
He was a reluctant teacher, as I think many writers are. But I was thrilled with the opportunity to, you know, work with him, listen to him, study under him. And so I reluctantly left New York because Syracuse is not exactly paradise for someone who's lived in Manhattan for a couple of years and fallen in love with it. But on the other hand, I had not only Raymond Carver, but also Tobias Wolff as my teachers there. And that was an extraordinary opportunity and, you know, one that I think I really benefited from. Mm.
Carver's relationship with his editors well documented. And I just wonder, thinking about Carver's relationship with Lish and Russell in the book's relationship with his young writer, Jack, and your relationship, in fact, with Gary, I'm interested in how you feel about that editorial.
Well, honestly, I think that the relationship you mentioned between Russell and this young writer, Jack Carson, is somewhat influenced by the Carver-Lish relationship. I was actually kind of present for the big conflict. Ray actually showed me a draft of this letter that he wrote to Gordon and eventually became kind of a famous document in this whole dispute, but in which he sort of basically says, look, you know, please, I'm sending you this new manuscript. Don't butcher it. I have to be me, you know. Basically kind of leave, you know, if you can't leave me alone, then goodbye. Mm. And this was Cathedral was the book in question. But Carver had really started to bristle at Lisch's editorial input, you know, or interference, as the case may be. His second book, What We Talk About When We Talk About Love, was pretty heavily edited by Lisch. And if you look at the difference between the first and the second book, you can see it's even more stripped down, more pared down. And Carver subsequently republished some of those stories in their original, longer form. You know, he always hated the fact that he was called a minimalist, although, you know, it seems like a fairly apt term for his writing. But he partly blamed Gordon for that. He felt that Lisch had sort of pared his writing down more than he wanted it to be pared down. So it was a very complicated and fraught relationship in the end, as is the relationship depicted in Bright Precious Days. You know, I think it's a tricky thing, writers and editors. There's something Oedipal there. This, you know, there's a kind of, I mean, editors tend to be, particularly for younger writers, you know, these authority figures. You know, they're a little bit like a parent. They're a little bit like a principal and a little bit like a teacher. But the relationship can reverse in a way if a writer becomes extremely successful, famous, admired, and then suddenly you can turn the relationship on its head in a sense. I've been very fortunate. I have an amazing, long, continuous relationship with my editor, Gary Fiskejohn, and from the first book to this one. And it must have been strange for him to read some of this stuff, because there's a lot about, you know, Russell is an editor, and he has very complicated relationships with his writers. And it's interesting to me that at no point did we engage that subject. At no point did he say, hey, you know, this is a little bit personal or close to the bone. It was all strangely professional. But I'm fortunate. We do have a good editorial relationship. And sometimes we fight and bicker and argue over commas even. But you know, the nice thing is that he always says at the end of the day, all right, it's your name on the book.
Mm-hmm. Now, Russell's relationship, as we've said, with Jack is somewhat problematic. But his relationship with his wife is very central to the book. And it endures over 20 years, doesn't it? Why haven't your relationships endured? Wife number four, I think we're on.
Why? I don't know. It seems... I suppose, you know, you could say that I'm not very good at it. On the other hand, you know, I don't know. I sometimes try to put a positive spin on it and say that I've had four really interesting marriages. You know, that's three more than most people have had. And they've all given me a great deal and taught me a great deal. But I was fascinated, because of my own history, with the idea of monogamy. And I think one of the reasons I like these characters so much is because, you know, I'm fascinated by the idea of people managing to stay married for, in this case, the Bright Precious Days, they celebrate their 25th anniversary. Seems extraordinary to me, although I'm coming up on my 10th, 2 months from now. But of course, a perfect marriage is dramatic poison. You know, I mean, nobody wants to read about a perfect couple. And in fact, it's hard to imagine one. But Russell and Corinne, I started with the idea of the perfect couple. You know, I think we all know those people. You know, you look at them, particularly when we're in our 20s, we're looking for role models. And there's that couple that's good looking and, you know, they entertain and they seem to have it all solved. You know, I knew several couples when I was in my 20s that sort of somewhat inspired this portrait of a marriage, and of course now they've all gone their separate ways. But I wanted to explore, you know, the road not taken in my case. You know, if I hadn't been a writer, I probably would have been an editor, and if I'd managed to stay married to my first wife, then it might resemble this marriage.
Well, in fact, that marriage broke up at a really tempestuous time for you. You lost your job, as you refer to. Your mother died. Mm. Being fired from The New Yorker?
Being fired from The New Yorker, of course, I probably turned out to be the best thing that ever happened to me, although at the time I didn't think so. Partly because I was working as a fact checker at the New Yorker, and aside from the fact that I'm not that interested in facts, I don't seem to have a great aptitude for them. And what I really wanted to be was a fiction writer. I wanted to be a novelist. I wanted my short stories to be published in the pages of the New Yorker, but I didn't really want to be sitting there making phone calls, asking people if it was true that they were 39 years old and how was their surname spelled, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, that was the level of work I was doing at the New Yorker. And my heart wasn't really in it. And it's one of the reasons I got fired. It's because my heart wasn't in it. And I don't have that type of personality. But it was devastating when I got fired because, you know, in some sense, even though I didn't love that particular job, when being hired by the New Yorker, I felt I'd arrived. You know, the New Yorker was kind of the center of the New York literary world in many ways. It stood for so much, and it seemed that I had arrived when I was hired there, and it seemed like I was cast into the outer darkness when I was fired.
But then, of course, you were published by the Paris Review.
Then the moment that I chose to leave Manhattan and go to Syracuse and study with Carver and Tobias Wolff. And it took me a while to realize that I should probably write about the worst things that had ever happened to me, which, you know, I mean, basically getting left by my wife, fired by the New Yorker, and having my mother die all within the space of a few months. You know, that eventually became the source of the inspirations for Bright Lights, Big City.
Which was famously written in just 6 weeks. Is that your normal process?
God, I wish. I wish I could write a book in 6 weeks again. You know, maybe the next one. The current one took me 3 years. Of course, it's a lot longer. Yeah, I really did write Bright Lights in 6 weeks. Obviously, it had been building up. And I'd spent years sort of struggling with the craft, and years writing, you know, imitating other writers, writing really bad stuff, walking in other writers' shoes. When I was at Syracuse, I sent a short story to the Paris Review, and I got a phone call from George Plimpton, who was the editor of the Paris Review. And I was shocked. I wasn't expecting to pick up the phone. You know, this was pre-email days. And hear this actually quite familiar patrician voice. Plimpton was, you know, he did movies and TV ads and so on. And he had this sort of famous fluty patrician voice. And he said that he'd gotten my story and he rather liked it. But he wondered if I had anything else before he decided whether or not to publish it. So when I hung up the phone, I immediately went through my drawer. And that night, I kind of read everything that I'd written up to that point. And I realized that it was mostly derivative and not very good. You know, one month I was imitating Ann Beattie, and the next month I was imitating Don DeLillo and so on. And yet, there was a scrap of paper in the pile, and it had a very short paragraph in the second person. It said, "You're not the kind of guy who'd be in a place like this at this time of the morning, but here you are." And it was something I'd written down after a disastrous night of nightclubbing, you know, having walked home with no money in my pockets about 4 a.m. And I had sort of noticed myself, because I was in an altered state of mind, I guess, I had noticed my internal monologue. I had stood in front of the mirror in the nightclub, and I said those words. And then I thought, oh, wow, this is interesting. I'm talking to myself. And of course, we do talk to ourselves usually in the second person, I think. You don't look in the mirror and say, "I idiot." You look in the mirror and say, "You idiot," you know? And so I wrote these lines down and I kind of forgot about them until this moment. And that night or that next day, I continued in that voice and I wrote a short story about a disastrous night in a nightclub. And sent it in, and the Paris Review very quickly accepted and published it, and that was essentially the first chapter of Bright Lights, Big City, mm-hmm. which I fairly quickly realized needed to be a little longer than a short story.
You've talked about your fondness for Russell and Corinne, and you killed off one of your main characters, Jeff Pierce, but he keeps coming back. At the time of writing his death, did you have any idea that these three books would be a series?
I had no idea. If I had, I don't think I probably wouldn't have killed Jeff off. But, you know, I think Jeff is a successful writer who has published. Number one, he's Russell's best friend. And number two, he's published by Russell. And, you know, I think that I wrote this book about Brightness Falls about, I don't know, 7 years after the publication of Bright Lights, Big City. And I think really I was kind of trying to kill off that part of myself. I was trying to kill off the Jay McInerney persona, you know, the bad boy author of Bright Lights, Big City. And you know, it certainly worked dramatically in the novel. But I remember when I decided to return to these characters singing, damn, maybe I shouldn't have killed Jeff off. But in fact, he never seems to go away because, you know, I think that our early 20s are just such a formative time. Mm-hmm. And these people came together then and they had this intense love triangle, really, a kind of Jules and Jim situation. And then Jeff really immortalized this affair that he had with his best friend's wife by writing a novel about it. And poor Russell has to publish the novel. So really, he never does go away because when we meet him in the new book, when we meet Russell in a new book, he's just becoming aware of this revival of Jeff's reputation after years of neglect. Young people are starting to discover his writing, and which seems to be part of a sort of 80s revival, as it were. But so I found a way to keep him in the books.
It's interesting that what you say about the 80s, because the only passages in the present tense are about the 80s. Yeah. As you say, the time of big hair and big shoulder pads. And I wonder if it's because it feels more present to you, if you can ever outrun Bright Lights, Big City, if you can ever kill off bad boy Jay McInerney.
You know, my agent early on, about a month after the book came out, said to me, you know, I hate to tell you, but she said, you know, the words Bright Lights, Big City are going to be in the first line of your obituary. Mm. And it's true. I'm never going to be able to escape that book. And when people stop me or accost me and say, I've read your book, I know, yeah. Although I've written 12 of them now, I know exactly what they mean.
Yeah.
And I know that they don't mean to to dismiss the rest of my career, but it was my 20s too. And it's such a vivid, informative time in your life. And it was a very interesting time in the history of New York. You know, I mean, New York was, in the 70s, New York sort of teetered between, you know, imploding and a renaissance. As it turned out, there was a renaissance. But when I arrived in late 1979, it was, you know, there was a heroin epidemic. Crime was rampant. There was garbage in the streets. It could have gone either way. But it was a fascinating time creatively. There was all this stuff happening downtown. There was the punk music scene. You know, I mean, punk was actually invented in the Lower East Side, and Malcolm McLaren happened to visit and figure out what was going on before probably the Americans did. But then there was this painting was being revived after years of conceptual art, and you know, people like Julian Schnabel and Jean-Michel Basquiat and Keith Haring were resurrecting the idea of painting. And it seemed to me when I moved there that this made it very exciting, and it seemed to me that there ought to be some kind of literary equivalent to these things, and there was all, you know, the nightclub scene was kind of fascinating. There was a sense of that somehow the nightlife was a sort of font for all this creative energy, a wellspring. And strangely enough, it was, you know, for years nobody really did write about it. I don't know if it's possible for a novel to deliver news about the culture now the way it was then, before the internet, before there were so many specialty publications.
I think you've
covering
done it, though,
so many niches, you?
You
know?
You've done it every decade since.
Well, yes, I hope. I hope. But yet, I don't think there's ever been quite the sense of surprise about like something happening that no one had noticed before. Mm-hmm. The Calloway books are written with a real sense of hindsight. Whereas Bright Lights, Big City, although it was about 1982, when it was published in 1984, everybody thought, bam, this is the present. Mm. And that's what the culture moved more slowly then.
Yeah. Drugs, a huge part of that time. I think you coined the phrase Bolivian marching powder.
I think I did.
I mean, difficult then to get away from that when everybody associates you with it.
It took years. I don't know. I mean, this new book in the States, the reception, it's almost the first time I felt like, oh, thank God, you know, they're finally letting me get away with the success of Bright Lights, Big City. And I think, you know, but partly because it's the third in a series, that finally, for me, with the American literary critics, there's been a sort of an acknowledgement that, hey, he has this other big project that he's been working on for years. And here's the what could be the culmination of it, I only write three of them. And that's, I don't know, I feel like I've been trying to escape Bright Lights for a long time. And in some sense, I never will. It just as the characters in the book are somewhat trapped in the 80s. Or not trapped in the 80s, but they keep remembering those years.
Join me next week for the final part of this interview with Jay McInerney. You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the production team of Claire Urban and Kieran Banerjee. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud, or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.